Well, good evening, everybody. So happy you could be here tonight. I don't know what you're expecting to hear when we talk about Mueller, mayhem, and midterm elections, but I think we'll come up with a few remarks and observations about those topics. You know, it occurred to me when we departed last week and I reiterated the title of tonight's program, I got home and saw the news and I says, darn, that should have been last week's program. It's hard to keep up, isn't it? It's an hourly change. So sometime around, oh, let's say 7:45, would you check your news and just let me know what new drama at 8. I think that's the name of our program. So anyway, it's terrific to have you here, and it's so great to have so many students here. Thank you all for coming out, and I look forward to hearing your questions. Wonderful. You know, how many months have we been talking about the Mueller investigation? It's been going on and on, hasn't it? And we don't yet know how far along Robert Mueller is. Just the other day, former Attorney General Eric Holder thought that this is probably a 2-year investigation. Do you have the stamina to go another 2 years? We're getting a little tired. But how often is it that Robert Mueller is pushed off page one to be replaced by a guy named Michael Cohen? Has anyone heard of Michael Cohen until just the last couple of months? Well, he's made a name for himself. I don't think his parents wanted him to make a name for himself when he was this high in the way he's done. But look at Michael Cohen. It was just last week that the Justice Department and the FBI executed a search warrant, went into his office, into his home, into his hotel room, into his safety deposit box, and gathered up hundreds of thousands of documents. I guess if you have hundreds of thousands of documents in your possession, you're a pretty busy guy. Well, when you have that many documents and you're such a busy guy, we want to know, what have you been busy doing? Well, we got a little hint of that when he appeared in court after he didn't appear in court the day he was supposed to be there. And the federal judge, Kimba Wood, said, by the way, you will be here next time or else. And he showed up. And what did we learn? He has apparently 3 clients. You've heard of one of the clients. The other two include a high-powered GOP fundraiser who got in some trouble with a Playboy bunny, had to pay $1.5 million, and that was facilitated by Michael Cohen. Apparently, it's the only legal work that Michael Cohen's ever done for this fellow, which left the mystery man as that third client, whom Michael Cohen's attorneys did not want to name in court. That's a name you shall not repeat. It seems like that comes out of a movie. And when the judge said, well, we're going to hear this name, and he said Sean Hannity, just as Sean Hannity was on the radio or TV doing his thing, and the little scrawl at the bottom of the page says Sean Hannity has been named as the client, boy, that guy had to do some fancy footwork, didn't he? And so then what did he say? Sean Hannity said, no, I'm not a client. I did call him on a few occasions. It was principally for some advice about real estate. Principally some real estate. Then he backtracked and had to say, well, yes, I am a client. And oh, yes, we have attorney-client privilege, of course. Everything we discuss was privilege. But I never asked Mr. Cohen to represent me with respect to a third party. It was always something else. Then we learned that in this treasure trove of documents, Sean Hannity's name is indeed on a good many documents. So stay tuned. I don't think, with all due respect, I don't think you'll get the answer immediately about what his business was if you watch Fox News. But if you watch some other networks, you might get some insight. So here we have three clients, and I didn't mention the third client. You might have heard him. His name's Donald Trump. We have three clients whose work product, apparently, has now been seized by the FBI and the Justice Department in execution of a search warrant. And I need to clarify, not breaking into offices, as President Trump described it, but in fact, in execution of a search warrant, which the government's attorneys obtained only after persuading the judge that there was indeed probable cause to believe that Michael Cohen and perhaps a client were involved in some criminal actions. And you have to believe, because client number one, the President of the United States, had documents in the possession of Michael Cohen, that the judge was going to be sure that there was indeed demonstrable probable cause, not taking that term lightly, knowing all the ramifications that would flow from the signature on the search warrant granting of the search. So here we have a very interesting situation. It bears reminder that this is all the handiwork of the Southern District of New York. This is not Robert Mueller. This is not Robert Mueller. As much as Mueller's detractors would like us to believe through some obscure language in news reports, this is not Robert Mueller. It's true that when Robert Mueller and his team were looking through a lot of documents, that they came upon something that suggested to them that maybe Michael Cohen was engaged in some criminal activities. So instead of personally investigating whatever those alleged criminal activities might be, on the premise, Mueller might have thought that he could expand his own sphere of jurisdiction, enlarge his responsibilities. He avoided that because that would have been terribly controversial, even though the last time we had a special prosecutor, whose name was Ken Starr, who took down Bill Clinton, that's exactly what Ken Starr did, expanded his sphere of responsibility. And that generated a lot of controversy, but Robert Mueller is so buttoned up, I think he wears triple buttons everywhere, so buttoned up he would not have even considered the idea of investigating these alleged criminal activities by Michael Cohen, so he properly referred the matter to the Southern District of New York, another arm of the Justice Department. This way he handed it off. Now, we learned in court last week that, in fact, the Mueller team had been investigating Cohen's wide-ranging activities for several months. So this was not just the first time that they stumbled across a document, and that raises the question, what would Michael Cohen possibly have been doing that would have caught the eye or the attention of the Mueller team? And we don't know exactly yet. But it looks as though he may have been engaged in alleged criminal activities. Am I saying alleged enough? Allegedly, there are alleged criminal activities involving bank fraud, involving wire fraud, involving campaign finance violations, perhaps among others, which would of course fall within the realm of federal violations, felonies, giving the U.S. Justice Department, in this case the Southern District of New York, the legal authority to investigate. Now that's important to remember, and I'm going to talk about this point that I'm about to make in a little bit more detail later, but some have wondered, what if Robert Mueller were somehow discharged, fired? What would that end the investigation? Well, actually not, and I say I want to talk about this in detail later, but the very fact that the state of New York Attorney General is looking at similar alleged activities means that even if Mueller were fired, some of the same charges, some of the same allegations involving Mr. Cohen at the federal level would be subject to investigation and perhaps indictment in the state of New York, because the bank fraud laws and the campaign finance laws are so similar, meaning it's very likely that Robert Mueller has turned over to the state attorney general, a man named Schneiderman, the documents that could be utilized by Schneiderman to continue the investigation in case Robert Mueller were fired. So how's that for an opener, just on what occurred when we finished here last week at 8:30 p.m. and you went home, you turned on your TV, and you saw mayhem occurring. Was mayhem too strong a word? If you look in the dictionary, it includes at least some chaos, doesn't it? A lot of confusion. I think that's probably an apt characteristic. So here we are, Mueller, mayhem, and the midterm elections, and they all tie together. They are linked very closely, and I imagine they're going to be seen to be viewed even more closely linked as the weeks or months, or dare I invoke Eric Holder, years to come. Years to come. Why do we say years, by the way? Because if you think back to Watergate, the Watergate break-in occurred on June 17, 1972. And Nixon was not ousted until after the Supreme Court delivered its decision on July 24, 1974, more than 2 years, ordering President Nixon to turn over the Watergate tapes, which indeed brought down his presidency. If you're wondering, are there any parallels between that stage of the Watergate investigation and where we are now, think about this. Imagine, if you will, when the first news stories came out, published by the Washington Post back in June of 1972, the president's teams dismissed those stories as less than credible, said that the Washington Post was motivated politically, because its owner was a liberal Democrat, its editor-in-chief, Ben Bradley, was an old Kennedy confidant, and said, this is a political con job. Does that name con job ring any bells these days? It wouldn't be much longer before the Nixon team would begin to dismiss the Watergate investigation as a, quote, witch hunt. And Republicans were attacking Democrats. No Republicans were supportive of the investigation. Even that summer, after the Post was publishing the stories, no less a personage than David Brinkley, the very admirable anchor on NBC News, was describing those early stories as flat, nothing to them, and probably just reflection of partisan politics. Well, you can't blame David Brinkley entirely, because almost everybody in the news business, with the exception of the Washington Post people, held that view about the break-in and the subsequent investigation. So it took a great deal of hard work by reporters at the Washington Post to convince other newspapers and other networks to begin to pick it up, to join in the fun, and to begin to publish the stories. It took 2 long years. So if Eric Holder is correct, I don't know where we are in the midst of this investigation, although Holder would say he thinks this investigation's moving very closely. And if you follow the comments of some veterans of the Watergate investigation, they will say it appears that Mueller already has a basis for charging the President of the United States with obstruction of justice, and is gathering the information to move forward on the issue, on the matter of collusion or conspiracy. Wow, if that's true, then buckle up. Stay tuned because there's a great deal ahead of us. Now, in the midst of all this, you may have noticed, James Comey's book came out, right? How many of you saw his interview on ABC with George Stephanopoulos last Sunday? Did you catch that? Or any of the numerous interviews that he's done, including one this morning on the Today Show, talking about this book. James Comey, the title of the book, Higher Loyalty, has a lot of interest and motivation to speak publicly about his interaction with President Trump, hasn't he? And so we find now that James Comey has said that he would like a do-over. If he had a time machine, he'd go back and he would not have held that press conference in July of 2016 where he announced to the world, we're not going to move forward with any charges or certainly not heading down a path toward indictment of candidate Hillary Clinton. But he went on to say, boy, was she reckless. And he all but indicted her by speaking out of turn. You'll remember that it's not the job of the FBI director to indict, just to conduct an investigation and decide whether or not they want to move forward. He said he would like a do-over. And he would also like a do-over for what he said just the week before the presidential election regarding Hillary Clinton. We'll always wonder, this will be the big question mark overhanging the 2016 presidential election. What if James Comey had not done one or both of those things? Would we have a different occupant in the White House? I happen to think so. I think it made that big a difference in the minds of a sufficient number of Americans to have turned the election in favor of Donald Trump. Those details are for another time. So we have Mueller conducting his investigation, and for the time being, at least, he's been bumped from the lead story on page one. It's all about Michael Cohen. Think about the drama now in Judge Kimba Woods' courtroom. You may know that it was Ronald Reagan that nominated Kimba Wood. So let's keep that in mind, because I'm sure whatever happens in terms of Judge Wood's rulings on the question of who is going to review these hundreds of thousands of documents, if President Trump is disappointed, he's certainly going to say, well, she's a Democrat, right? So keep in mind that President Reagan nominated. Now let's also keep in mind the reality of how people are nominated and appointed to the federal bench. The president and the Senate work closely. For many, many years, there's been deference to the U.S. senators from the state in which there's an open seat. In that case, at that point in time, the senator, there were two senators from New York, Gus D'Amato and Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And Moynihan had actually worked out a deal with his fellow senator, which very much redounded to his favor. He said the minority senator should always be able to pick one out of four of the judges. It's only fair. Otherwise, Moynihan would say, I would have to work against your nominee. So just give me one out of every four nominees, 25%. He was the one that suggested Kimba Wood. And here she is on the court. She was nominated by President Clinton to be the United States Attorney General in the early 90s, but she had to withdraw her name because she learned that her nanny was an undocumented, in those days, an illegal immigrant. She didn't have to be told to withdraw her name. A woman of great integrity, she said, I realize I'm in violation of the law, so I'm withdrawing my name. Now, as you may know, there have been all kinds of candidates to be U.S. Attorney General, even higher office, President of the United States, who have had a few scrapes with the law. And they've not removed their names. Nominees to the Supreme Court have not removed their names. It's only after some scandal or even a mini-scandal has occurred that their names have been withdrawn. So, for example, speaking of President Reagan, when he nominated a gentleman to the Supreme Court in the late mid-1980s, it was learned that he had been smoking marijuana with the students at the Harvard Law School. So they withdrew his name. The professor was too busy smoking marijuana to think about withdrawing his own name. So these things happen. And if you want some bipartisan flavor here, I'll give it to you. When Lyndon Johnson nominated his good friend, Justice Abe Fortas, to become Chief Justice to replace Earl Warren, it was learned that in fact, Abe Fortas had associations with some people whom you wouldn't want to associate with in the area of Las Vegas. I'm not saying he was associating with a crime family. I'm not saying that. Some people did. So his name was withdrawn. Another subject for another time. Mueller's investigation is now overshadowed by Cohen because of the drama in Judge Kimba Wood's chambers. The big decision that she's required to make now is whether she appoints an attorney who would be characterized or denominated a special master who is given the authority to peruse all those documents to determine which of the documents should enjoy attorney-client privilege as opposed to those which are, in fact, relevant to perhaps, say, the commission of a crime. That's a big job. The special master will have a big team of attorneys. The judge so far has indicated that she, as you saw, she has complete confidence in the integrity of the attorneys in the Justice Department in the Southern District for New York. And so that's likely what she's going to do. Rather than allowing President Trump to and Michael Cohen to have all the documents as they asked the court to do, saying you could trust us to go through them and we'll decide which of those documents should enjoy the attorney-client privilege and we'll return the others. Judge Wood was not going for that. Nor was she willing, on the other hand, to give the government the first look. So this seems like very even-handed justice, and we expect soon that she'll appoint a special master. And then, of course, we'll have to wait a while to find out which documents can be turned over, which documents enjoy attorney-client privilege. One of the lurking issues, one of the big issues here on the issue of on Donald Trump being able to invoke attorney-client privilege, because the privilege is attached to the client, and Donald Trump would like everything privileged. One of the problems here, we've learned, is Michael Cohen may not have been doing much lawyering for Donald Trump. He might have just been doing business deals, which would not fall into the realm of the attorney-client privilege. If this is the case, then there may not be many documents that are protected, in which case we understand from news reports that Donald Trump is quote-unquote terrified about the implications of not being able to claim the privilege to protect these documents. So stay tuned for all of that. What possible mayhem has occurred? What possible confusion, convulsions, chaos within our country? Well, we now know that Michael Cohen is a very nervous man. Think about this. If Michael Cohen were to be charged and convicted of at least a couple of these alleged crimes, federal bank fraud or wire fraud, he could go to prison for 15, 20, 25 years. A very long time for a man who has children. And that raises the distinct possibility that Michael Cohen might roll over, technical legal term, and cooperate with Robert Mueller and perhaps with the Southern District. He knows, boy, this is not a good term to use with respect to a client who behaves like a consigliere, but he knows where all the bodies are buried. And so he could tell a great story about all the president's business activities in which he was involved. If you are Michael Cohen, here's an audience survey here. If you're Michael Cohen and you're looking at 20 years in prison, not being there to watch your kids grow up, not being there to enjoy life with your wife, do you exhibit loyalty to your client Donald Trump, or would you rather be home? Simple survey. How many of you would show loyalty to President Trump? Couple of you. And the rest of you, how many of you want to be home, eating some good food, playing with your kids, going golfing? So he's in a position to strike a very good deal if indeed the allegations appear to be subject to demonstration. Now if you're Donald Trump, speaking of mayhem and fear and confusion and chaos, your biggest nightmare is that, in fact, Michael Cohen, who's handled so much of your business, known as the fixer, and who, by the way, apparently did show up in Prague, contrary to his denial, meeting with Russian oligarchs who apparently were doing business with Donald Trump and the Trump business empire. That's your biggest nightmare, that he's going to roll over and cooperate, spill the beans on everything. So if you're the president of the United States, will you say, it's not a big problem, Michael, I'm going to grant you a pardon. So don't worry. I'll pardon you if you're indicted for any of these federal offenses. That might help Donald Trump breathe a sigh of relief, but not for long, because remember what we said earlier. The state of New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman has basically the same, we assume, has basically the same documents and could charge Michael Cohen for similar crimes, and a presidential pardon does not reach state offenses. It's important to remember that under the Constitution, the president's pardon power, which is very sweeping, can only pardon offenses committed against the United States, not state offenses. In the case of New York bringing charges, in that hypothetical, it would require a pardon from the governor of the state of New York. Anybody remember who the governor of the state of New York is? A leading Democrat, Cuomo. He's not likely to pardon. So that means that there's going to be no protection for Donald Trump, no way to protect himself from Michael Cohen rolling over and sharing information. So there are dark days ahead for President Trump. Now, on this point, what about on this point of Donald Trump having the tools or the resources to rid himself of the Mueller nightmare? That's probably how he views it now, the Mueller nightmare. Could he fire Robert Mueller? The answer is no. What he could do, of course, is to fire Rod Rosenstein, who is wearing two hats, both as acting attorney general for purposes of the Mueller investigation and, of course, deputy attorney general overseeing the investigation. Trump has several times said angrily that he regrets that he ever appointed Rosenstein. And remember, he had to do that because Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, recused himself from the Russian investigation, which outraged Donald Trump in the first instance. And then when Rosenstein proceeded to grant pretty broad authority to Robert Mueller to pursue this investigation, Donald Trump had yet more outrage. You wonder what his blood pressure numbers look like these days. That's an important matter. So if he were to fire Rosenstein, then on the premise that he could find somebody in the Justice Department to replace Rosenstein, who might then fire Bob Mueller, then the question arises, who in the Justice Department wants to be appointed to that position to be known for all of American history that he was the person who fired the special counselor on the theory that he could end the investigation into what are potentially criminal activities by the president? What do you want to read? What words do you want on your headstone? You don't want, "He fired Robert Mueller." I don't think so. So one of the concerns, and this was stated by James Comey in an interview today, he doesn't think that there would be anybody in the Justice Department who would step forward, accept that appointment, with the understanding that he would fire Mueller. That was similar to what Richard Nixon faced in October of 1973 in the evening called the Saturday Night Massacre, when he asked the Attorney General to fire the special prosecutor, Archibald Cox. Elliot Richardson said no. Then he went to the next, and he resigned, and then he went to the number two guy who said no, so you're gone. He went down the list of ways and then found Robert Bork, and Bork agreed to do it, but it didn't mean the end of the investigation, did it? Because then Leon Jaworski was appointed to succeed Archibald Cox, and he was every bit as dogged in his investigation. In fact, it was Jaworski that ultimately decided to indict the president as, quote, an unindicted co-conspirator. Some technicalities, we could talk about that later. But the point is, Nixon thought he could end the investigation by firing Archibald Cox. It didn't. It continued. And in fact, if President Trump were to do an all-out Nixon move and he tried to find somebody to replace Rosenstein, the question is, could he find somebody? Secondly, if what usually happens in an ongoing investigation is that you don't drop the investigation, the Justice Department, anybody who succeeded Rosenstein, would finish the investigation. So we already know there are indictments, right? And those indictments have to be brought to trial. We already know that there are plea bargains. Those plea bargains have to be finalized. And so firing Mueller is not necessarily going to end the investigation at the federal level, and there would be great pressure brought to bear on the Senate Judiciary Committee to hire Robert Mueller to lead the investigation from the Senate side. So if you are Donald Trump, you're looking for an exit strategy, and it's very, very hard to find. That is real concern. Those are deep, dark days. And what causes greater problems for President Trump these days from a personal standpoint is most of his good friends whom he brought to the White House have left. They're gone. So he doesn't have good friends, confidants that he can talk to inside the White House. So what have we learned in just the last few days about the person whom Trump staffers refer to as the virtual chief of staff in the White House, a man who has a desk there in the White House? It's Sean Hannity. Hannity and Trump apparently talk several times a week. We now know they talk early in the morning, and it's been suggested that Sean Hannity probably suggests some tweets that President Trump might send out in the morning. And if you happen to watch some of those early morning talk shows, Morning Joe, for example, several times when I've been watching it and I hear the commentators and they interrupt their discussion for a second to say, "Just a second, we've got a tweet from the president," and so they read it. And so we wonder now, learning about Sean Hannity's role, Is he in fact making suggestions? Is he suggesting language? And then the other time they talk is at the end of the night after Sean Hannity signs off to all of you, and he then, or maybe, and then he calls the president and they have a late night chat about the daily activities and maybe planning what should be tweeted in the morning. Now, there's nothing illegal about Sean Hannity playing this large role as a virtual chief of staff. His role has increased, as I say, with the departure of Trump's good friends and confidants, or having a desk in the White House somewhere. There's nothing illegal, but wow, think about the ethical problems that Hannity now is surrounded with. Look at the ethical problems that are mounting and that are on top of him. Just go back to any time in the last several weeks, or I dare say months, in which on his program, Sean Hannity has trashed the people who are participating in the Mueller investigation, saying Mueller is out to get our president. He's out to destroy the country. And then in more recent weeks, as Michael Cohen has come into the news more frequently, there is Sean Hannity coming to the defense of Michael Cohen, the president's integrity, the president's attorney, a man of great integrity and accomplishment, never mentioning that he is Michael Cohen's client. Any journalistic principle involving ethics would require disclosure. This is a real problem for Fox News, a real problem for Sean Hannity. It could deepen if we find that his name is on a number of documents suggesting that Michael Cohen did some work for him. That's more chaos, more headaches for the president, but also for Sean Hannity. And so we get a sense of a cozy little triangle here, folks, between the president of the United States, Fox News, and Sean Hannity. The deeper question, the most alarming question for us about this triangle, one that people are beginning to talk a lot about, is Fox News state media doing the bidding of the president? If so, that's very alarming. But what if, as it's been suggested, that Sean Hannity works so much influence on Trump that it's Fox News driving the state? If either is true, it's deeply alarming for the United States. What, if anything, does all this have to do with midterm elections? So, you're aware that in November, we have midterm elections. And you know that for weeks and some months now, there's been an increased volume of commentary on the perceived likelihood that the Democrats could regain control of the House and the Senate, which would then prove to be very challenging for President Trump. So what do we make of the midterms? It seems to me there are several different angles very much worthy of discussion. Let's start with the fact that we already have a record number of women who are running for seats in the House of Representatives. 472 have filed. That's an enormous number. It is a record number. Isn't that incredible? 472 women. Now, we can only speculate as to why women have filed. So many women have filed to run for the House of Representatives against President Trump. Interesting subject to speculate about. Let's assume we all understand partly why. His gross comments on what he could do with women, the body parts that he could grab, other activities in which he has, let's say, violated the rights of women. Let's just leave it at that. We don't need to fill in details now. Women are highly motivated to run, and that means that many voters who are very much drawn to their campaigns, including more women, are expected to vote, particularly in those white suburbs of major cities, from Philadelphia to Chicago to Los Angeles, in the case of Orange County, and several other major cities. If more women turn out to support female candidates rather than to support Republican candidates, this will be doom and gloom for the GOP. That has led to a great deal of speculation as to why so many incumbents in the GOP have decided not to run again, including the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. That was more news from last week. Paul Ryan is retiring. Certainly, one of his concerns, in addition to the usual explanations, I want to spend more time with my family, and I have some opportunities to pursue in the private sphere, no, private sector, no doubt that's true. But the concern that he could even lose his seat in a close race, which would be very embarrassing, and in fact, Democrats know that. That happened 35 years ago when the Speaker of the House from state of Washington was defeated in his own district. But beyond that, somebody who's been Speaker of the House doesn't want to have to leave that office and become a member of the minority. Others have suggested, and so therefore a lot of pundits have suggested, he perceives this blue wave coming that's going to sweep over the House in which Democrats retake control of the House. And that is, it's speculated, driving the retirements of a lot of incumbents. Some 40 Republicans have decided not to seek re-election. Democrats need to win 24 seats to flip control of the House. Is it doable? It certainly seems doable. Whether it will happen is another question. Why isn't it guaranteed? Well, nothing's ever guaranteed in politics. We know that. And given the changing drama in Washington, not by the month, not by the week, not by the day, but by the hour, who knows what will occur in the intervening months before we all go to vote in November. One of the concerns that Democrats have just in the last week or two has been that Donald Trump's poll numbers, his approval ratings, actually gone up to 40% from 34, 35%. A lot of people wonder, well, how can that possibly be? He doesn't get over 40. Sometimes he's been at 41, but his rising numbers have caused that prospective lead that Democratic candidates have been assumed to hold to shrink to 4%. That's a very small margin, now 4%. But what we should remember is, as the Michael Cohen investigation continues, and perhaps his indictment, and perhaps the release to the public of information tying Cohen with President Trump in alleged criminal activities, you would expect then that the stain on President Trump would cause his approval ratings to drop. We could assume that. And if, in fact, the Mueller investigation continues to bear fruit with respect to other cooperative witnesses or indictments, that too could hurt Donald Trump. So even though the Democrats are holding their breath a little bit as they see that lead shrink to 4 points, it may be the case that in another couple of weeks or month or two, that could swell back to double digits. So it's too soon for anybody to worry about. But again, nothing's guaranteed in American politics, right? One of the most troubling features to me about the midterms is the number of white supremacists who are on the ballot for the House of Representatives around the country. White supremacists and the far-right militia now can count almost 20 candidates. 20 candidates who are running. Now, why is this alarming? Think about this. It was just in the last primary election in a suburb in Illinois that a white supremacist, a neo-Nazi who ran as a Republican candidate, netted some 20,000 votes. Isn't that amazing? That's very sad that a candidate who's a white supremacist advocating Nazi doctrines could win 20,000 votes in this day and age. Other candidates seeking office in the House don't have any restraints when they talk about their views grounded in the Nazi ideology and the horrific doctrine and exaggerations, gross distortions. So one of the candidates, who is a Republican candidate running in Paul Ryan's district, said, in effect, if you think about all the scourges of mankind, you think about all the poop, and you think about all the pedophilia, isn't it amazing that, in fact, so many Jews are guilty of pedophilia and spreading poop to link and get this, the charge that most of the mass murderers have been Jews. Horrific, total BS, but the very fact somebody can stump for a seat in the House of Representatives in this day and age on that garbage is alarming to us because it says that they are comfortable running for political office. It's only been recently that members of the Nazi Party and white supremacists have come out to run as candidates for the House or for the United States Senate, for that matter, and for state offices, because always before they assumed they could not get any votes, so they wouldn't even participate in politics. They would say the system was rigged. But with the ascension of President Trump to this high-profile position and his comments about the moral equivalency of the people who protested in Charlottesville last summer, you recall that, he drew a moral equivalency between the people who were there chanting ugly white supremacist Nazi doctrines with those people who were protesting intolerance, protesting racism, and when he drew a linkage between those two, it gave encouragement to white supremacists and neo-Nazis to run for office. This represents then a very dangerous part of our political climate. While everybody can run, and while everybody enjoys First Amendment free speech rights, it's frightening to see the level of confidence growing in these far-right people that they think now that they could, in fact, win votes. So these midterm elections from coast to coast promise to be fascinating, and the implications are huge. The implications are huge. If, in fact, the Democrats should retake control of the House, you can almost be certain that articles of impeachment will be drawn up against the president. If the Democrats don't regain control of the House, but the Mueller report and perhaps the investigation into Michael Cohen reveals that President Trump was in, that in fact Michael Cohen was doing President Trump's bidding in business with the Russian oligarchs at the in violation of American law at the expense of America's security, that might still be enough if the House is very close. It might still be enough to bring about the introduction of articles of impeachment. But even setting aside the issue of impeachment for a second, it would mean, if Dems regain, a big turn in the policies being generated in Congress. And it would mean then that for all intents and purposes, it would deprive President Trump of the veto power. And if they should regain control of the Senate as well, that means that the Dems could make life miserable for President Trump. But what if that doesn't come to pass? What if the Republicans maintain control of the House and maintain control of the Senate and, of course, maintain control of the White House? That will send a signal to Americans everywhere that the American people were not rejecting President Trump's policies.